A young psychology student, the only black in his class at New York University, is puzzled by Jung's theory of the collective unconscious. How would it apply to Afro-Americans? Suddenly, young Aaron Rodgers disappears from the campus and joins the army and earns a battlefield commission in Vietnam. But soon his family is notified that he has been killed in action, and they are advised not to look at the shattered remains. Several other Afro-American families also receive the familiar military caskets with the same humane advice. Before any of these black soldiers can be buried, however, a series of raids executed with professional military finesse are made on the very centers of American life, on banks, on a radio station, on a political convention. In the last of these raids, the mysteriously resurrected Aaron Rodgers is killed a second time, this time glad that now something has been added to the collective unconscious that will change the future of both blacks and whites. That's the basic situation in a fast-moving novel called Operation Burning Candle. From this summary, you'd say offhand that such a blend of psychology, mystery, and techniques could be accomplished only by a seasoned writer like Graham Greene or Elliot Arnold. And that's what makes Operation Burning Candle such an astonishing feat. It's a first novel by a young man who, not so long ago, was a student in an adult NYU course called Basic Fiction Writing. His name is Blyden Jackson. He has that rare talent of being able to make maximum use of personal experience for bold fictional exploration. Blyden Jackson's teacher in basic fiction writing was Sidney Offutt, well known to our audience as a fiction writer and editor. Several months ago, Sidney alerted me in a memo on Intellectual Digest stationery that Operation Burning Candle would be a remarkable first novel. I say remarkable, Sidney wrote, because the narrative thrust of this story would be unusual in any novel. And Sidney's pride in his protege has been more than justified. The New York Times Book Review, which hardly ever notices first novels, gave a column and a half to Operation Burning Candle. Barbara Bannon has praised it and publishes weekly, and so has the Kirkus Service. And so I say to Blyden Jackson, congratulations on your early success.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Blyden Jackson, to me, the most lovable character in Operation Burning Candle is Pa, Aaron's father. What Aaron learns from Jungian psychology was something that Pa knew all along, just from his innate wisdom. Was it that discovery that a man without any formal education could intuit a main theory of modern psychology? Was that discovery the starting point in your design of the novel?
Yes, it was, as a matter of fact. Pa has always represented to me so many older black men who have never had any formal kind of education, never had any life experiences outside of poverty, the ghetto, that kind of thing, and who through what most black people call mother wit have arrived at a view of the world and an understanding of themselves and other people, which is really profound.
Yeah, that's a kind of understanding of people that you're invited to have if you're an outsider in the society.
Yes, it is. It is. Richard Pryor, the comedian, does that joke about the old wino who pretends he's an FBI man who can speak Mexican. And it has some of that flavor. It's picking up from here and there.
Is he a composite, Pa? I mean, a composite of many men that you've known in that situation?
Yeah. I can remember, I grew up in New Haven, Connecticut, and I used the library down there quite frequently as a kid. And I can remember stumbling over guys like this in the library, in the back, often with a bottle of wine, often not, and getting in conversations and probably learning quite a bit more from them than I did from many of the books that I read there.
Your knowledge of tactics plays a major role in the novel, too. And I guess you came to that through your experience in the Marine Corps.
That's right, yeah.
But how did you come by such inside knowledge of the workings of the police and fire departments?
Well, the police, I guess I got mainly from spending a half a dozen years in the civil rights movement in the North and the South. I've always had an interest in police and what makes them work as individuals and as units, probably an outgrowth of my real interest in the military. And I began to pick up here and there information and retain it and began to talk to black policemen that I knew and that sort of thing. I think maybe I'm really a guy who wanted to be a policeman and did something less by becoming a writer, really. Firemen, I've just always loved. I still chase engines, so love it.
So in a sense, you have a real admiration for the hero.
For men who are called on, for ordinary seeming men who are called on at the spur of the moment to do extraordinary things. That always fascinates me.
It seems in this novel, at least, that you believe that reader interest should be achieved through an exciting plot. And that goes along with this hero business too, doesn't it? And that intellectual concepts can best be advanced through action. Do you think of any one author, maybe Ralph Ellison or Lonnie Elder, whose work taught you this approach?
Ralph Ellison.
Really?
I guess I've read The Invisible Man 6 times easily. But I do believe that that you have to hold the reader, that you have to give the reader the motivation to keep going, to pick up the book, or maybe hopefully not even set it down kind of thing, while you're trying to get your message across. I think that's the first duty of a writer, is to really hold the reader to the book.
The story. The basic story. I thought of both Ralph Ellison and Lonnie Elder because of the fantastic way that you could keep the action going, several lines of the story going at once. I thought that was, well, you know, when Lonnie Elder writes a script for NYPD,
uh-huh.
You've got 4 lines of action going at once. And, well, what, aside from Ralph Ellison, who are your major influences? I also had a hunch that you like Graham Greene, or at least you should.
Yeah, and Herman Melville, interestingly enough, puts together a magnificent story as far as I'm concerned. It's so corny, but I love people like Kazantzakis. The Last Temptations of Christ has always deeply impressed me. It's difficult to say because you read so many people and you literally steal so much from what other guys have done and are doing around you. I can sit down with any good novel and really get into it.
You get us quite well into the story before you introduce any of the intellectual concepts that the story is really based on. And I like that, because by the time we're sitting in a psychology class listening to a really heady discussion, the story is up to such a flying, you know, speed that we're able to take that all in our stride. Well, you have attended university classes like Aaron Rodgers in the book, but the writing class must have been quite different from the psychology class that Aaron Rodgers goes to. There's a lot of profound discussion about personality and motivation and so on, but I gather that in your experience in writing class, what you go for is criticism.
Yeah, essentially it's... Especially if you don't have a formal education in literature or English or something like that, it becomes extremely valuable to have someone objective, which is usually the professor and the class, deal with your work. I think that's the only way you can really begin to get a perception about what you're doing and whether it's good or not, really. I think the other important thing about writing classes, especially Sid Offutt's, is that he draws the kind of people that are really into writing and are not fishing around, not trying to decide. They pretty much decided. And so you get the kind of criticism from people who are equally serious about their own work, which puts the whole thing on another level, I believe.
Yeah, that can be an intense 2 hours in his class, can't it?
And often has been, believe me.
Yeah. You know, in the 10 years that I've known him, maybe more than that, in teaching of writing, this is only the second time that he has sent out any bragging about students.
I bet you I can tell you the first one.
Who was the first one?
Barry. God, I can't think of his last name.
Can't think of it? No, that wasn't...
He wrote a book, a novel called My Main Mama, My Main Mother, which was a first novel, which was very well received. Yeah, he's teaching up at Brown now, I believe.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know him, but I know of him through Sid. Yeah.
Well, this is how rarely, you know, he gets excited about any story. Have you read his novels?
Most of them, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I was wondering whether writing students read the teacher's stuff or stay away from it. Because, I don't know, I meet a lot of students of L.J. Davis, for example, who find him such a fascinating teaching, yet they never think of reading his novels, almost as though that's going to ruin the perfection of it all, you know?
Yeah, I can see that. Uh-huh.
These blacks that are described in Operation Burning Candle as killed in action in Vietnam, They're actually resurrected like Lazarus. Had you intended to continue that Lazarus symbolism that Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm X and Cleaver have used? Was that conscious, or was that part of the...
I'm not sure if that's exactly where I was going. What I had to do was solve the problem of how do you get a group of guys back who are ready to do the kinds of things these guys did without the police being aware? Because the normal police tactic is when a group of blacks come together and have anything that appears to be revolutionary aspirations, they are immediately infiltrated, and then a series of other tactics follow. And Aaron, aware of this, was trying to guard against that. And so he joined the Army mainly to do his recruiting in Vietnam and to get around that problem. And getting around the problem was the business of getting them secretly back.
That's a very good plot trick. I think Graham Greene would be very envious of that. Well, having gotten such good results with your first novel, now what's happening? Are you working on another one?
Yeah, I sold a second novel, and it's due the 15th of... within 30 days, actually. Less than that.
That's rapid succession.
Yeah, the publisher was kind of enthusiastic about the first, so we sat right down and made another deal. This one's about Africa and American blacks. I being black, really enjoy writing to black folks is where I'm really at. The basic plot is a missing statue, a totem, that was put together just before Europeans arrived in Africa, which symbolized the unity of African people. And it was, of course, lost because that unity was broken. And now, as Africa aspires to unity and true freedom throughout Africa, and blacks in this country have grown close to Africa, rumor has it that the statue is around again, and a small group of young men go to Africa in search of it and run into opposition from South African police, neo-colonialist black African governments, and that sort of thing. And the legend of the statue unfolds. It's all in there. The legend unfolds, et cetera, and so forth. I hope to finish it shortly.
Have you been to Africa?
No, I've never been there. No. I've read quite a bit. The first thing I ever had published was a nonfiction piece about South Africa and American involvement in the apartheid system there. Mm-hmm. Know quite a few Africans, so that's the great thing about fiction. You're allowed to let your imagination run away. Once you've got the basic foundation of facts, you can pretty much have a good time with things.
Yeah, but I would imagine that most of the military stuff in Operation Burning Candle comes right out of personal experience. I think anybody with military training knows that it's real.
I have not been to Vietnam, but I've talked to a considerable number of guys who have, and all of them, after reading the novel, say that it was the spirit of what happened in Vietnam was definitely caught. Mm-hmm. A lot of them marvel at the fact and insist that I certainly must have been there, and what regiment was I with, and that sort of stuff. Again, it's a tactic of getting the basic factual foundation and feel, and then letting your head do its number, mm-hmm. which I really enjoy.
I gather then that once you get the basic plot gimmick, you work fast.
Yeah. It takes me quite a bit of time just in my head to get the plot. And once I see the ending, even though I don't have all the characters and don't have it all filled in, but once I see the thin outline, then I go, yeah, no problem after that. It's getting it together up front.
When you were talking about the totem, I thought, of course, of your barbershop scene, which it seems to me in Operation Burning Candle. John Oliver Killen says that the barbershop scene is practically an obligation for the black writer. That's such an important...
That's great, yeah.
You know, it's practically such an important place.
It is, yeah. I guess it's comparable to the Yale Club or the Princeton Club or wherever Wall Street brokers go to drink beer. I suppose they don't drink beer. Or the Congressional Club. It's that one totally masculine area where information and intelligence is both exchanged and challenged, and one really has to know what one is talking about before you get in an argument in a barbershop. Again, Pa is in that barbershop, and Pa knows. He may not be able to write it out or to say it in good English, but he knows, and he'll challenge you, which is the nature of barbershops. In many barbershops, very little haircutting goes on, especially with the afros.
I gather from your barbershop scene and from John Oliver Killen's is that It's a place where manhood is on the line. The barber, for example, is challenged about candles and he has to send out immediately for candles.
Yeah, it's all of that. It's there have been. It's of course changing. So few places for black men to really let down their hair, if you will, and just open up without the feeling that they're going to be unnecessarily challenged. In other words, the argument is always based on fact. And in almost every barbershop I know, you'll find the Guinness Book of World Records, and you'll find all of the baseballs and sports statistics and all of that. And, of course, there's quite a bit of minor betting that goes on. But the arguments can be fantastic, especially when they're political. Especially when they're political.
Putting that together with something you said before, I would imagine that they would be infiltrated, too.
I'm not sure that the police are yet that ready to to saturate us, if you will. No, it's more of a broad kind of thing. It involves religious arguments as well as political discussions and all of that, and it ranges from all ends of the political spectrum. It's never any kind of isolated thing. What you essentially have is a group of men who have no other formal or informal place to gather and pound each other's brains and pick each other's minds. That's what the black barbershop is really all about.
And a man stays there for a long time, doesn't he? Much, much longer than it takes to get several haircuts.
Sure. Guys show up on a Saturday morning at 9 or 10, and it might involve the sharing of a bottle in the course of 4 or 5 hours and the greeting of various people who are coming in and out and that sort of thing. And a few might even get haircuts while they're there.
In Ceremonies and Dark Old Men, you remember, Lana Yelda makes that the main scene, doesn't he? What, you were talking before about your nonfiction. Were you having to write nonfiction before you were able to settle down into fiction?
No, I had been working for a group that was working on the problems of apartheid in South Africa, a group called the American Committee on Africa. And I was working in another field, but they wanted to do a study, and I volunteered to do it because everyone else thought it was going to be one of those things that came out like a college paper. And got into it from that angle. I always knew I wanted to write fiction and was writing while I was there, but I decided that there was an obligation to try and do the thing, and it worked out. It came out fairly well.
Is Third Press going to publish your next novel,
yeah,
too?
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Joseph Opaku's Third Press.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you'd tell us something about this press, because this is new. It's fairly new.
Yeah, it's a small but growing black publishing house run by a gent named Joseph Opaku, who is a Nigerian who came here several years back. He's done a number of books. He did Angela Davis's If They Come For You in the Morning. He did the very popular How to Get Along with Black Folks, which is a book directed at whites, which is has quite a few laughs in it. He does Miss Sanchez's poetry to blacks, that sort of stuff. And he's got people like Robin Moore. His next book is going to be done by Third Press. I like it because I feel very comfortable there. It's a small house, an intimate, informal kind of operation, although a very professional one. And I enjoy working with the folks up there who are very close to the kind of stuff that I'm doing. It does mainly black writers, but it does all kind of writers, but the majority of its books are by black writers.
Yeah, I noticed when I mentioned your book in one of my classes, it was the black students who were familiar with Third Press. That's a beautiful Nigerian name. I was wondering
isn't it?
The origin of that name was.
Yeah, glad Joseph Opaku.
Had he published in Nigeria?
I'm not sure of his history in Nigeria. He's done some things here, mainly small things. He's more interested in the publishing end of the thing, in building Third Press into a viable, good-sized black publishing house. And I think he's done a really good job with it, getting it together.
That's a big assignment. Small publishers usually find it difficult, for example, to get the distribution.
He's faced with all of the problems. That's correct. He's faced with a lack of an advertising budget, getting the books distributed on a national basis, that sort of thing. He's got tremendous drive and power. He's the kind of guy that makes things go. And he's built it slowly. He was working with some of the major publishers and finally decided to go on his own. And he has a number of salesmen, and he's hooked in with a number of independents. So he's building it. It is a building process. And I must say, I'm proud to be a part of it, really.
Well, if you can turn out a novel every 6 months, he should be very glad to have you.
I always get a cup of coffee when I go there. I know that.
Then you must be working on a third novel, actually, if the second one is in the works already.
Yeah, I hope to have the second one finished shortly. I have the thing that I really want to publish that I've been working on for 4 or 5 years, and have decided that as soon as I'm finished with this second one, I'm going to spend the next year on, is a thing about Bellevue. And that's my baby. That's the one I really am into and love. And, of course, since I love it so much, it'll probably not go anywhere. But I've spent a lot of time on that, and I really hope to finish it. So you can say I have the second one working and the third one, and then I don't know what I'm going to do.
What's
after
the title of the second one? Have you got a publishing title yet, or just a working title?
I fooled around with Waiting for Spring, and somewhere in the back of my mind, I think someone else has already used that, and I'm not quite sure yet. No, I don't know. Waiting for Spring, for the moment, is what it comes down to.
I heard a good story about working titles the other day. L.J. Davis had planned to call his fourth novel Memorial Day.
Mm-hmm.
And practically at the last minute, they discovered that some poet has got a book coming out called Memorial Day.
Yeah.
And there can really be no competition at all, but publishers are fanatic about this.
Certainly are.
So L.J. just had to come up with a title like that, and he came up with Walking Small.
That's great.
that's really terrific.
Uh-huh.
For at this moment. So the title of the second is still undetermined, and the third one is going to be about Bellevue. This now sounds, I don't want to probe too much if you're still working around it, but you're thinking in terms of the hospital as...
No, the mental ward.
The mental ward.
Yeah, it's a story about an 18-year-old black kid who comes from the South to go to school and is crushed by the whole urban pressure kind of thing. And not that isn't to say that he didn't have it all waiting to come out anyway. And it is put away in Bellevue for 30 days of observation. And it's his relationship with a half a dozen other guys, different ages, different races, that he's with for those 30 days on the ward in Bellevue. Two of whom want to get him to help them escape. And his choice is whether or not he's going to help them and his relationship in dealing with the others there. I like it. I've captured the feeling for it. It's a question now of getting it to come out of the typewriter.
I can see why you're a little apprehensive about it, too, because it's big. It's really big.
Yeah.
It's so small, it's big. It's going to be a...
It's bad enough dealing with so-called normal people. It really is intriguing when you get into people who are exhibiting their problems.
Yeah, but I can already see that this guy put away for 30 days of observation is going to be doing the observing of our society. It's going to be a microcosmic thing.
That's what I'm trying for, yeah.
Do you find in the second and third books that you're going to be going after, say, more poetry or more symbolism? Do you find yourself luxuriating in language now?
I'm finally getting the courage to relax and begin to enjoy it. I like dream sequences, which makes the Bellevue thing really work for me. I like that kind of flowing dream, almost subconscious probing of an individual, or allowing an individual character to expose himself through that method.
Mm-hmm.
And you can really get into language, which I am really just beginning to do. I've got an awful lot to learn, very honestly. So.
There's one lovemaking scene in Operation Burning Candle where you do that, where the language is poetic and the whole...
Yeah, I guess love inspires that in all of us, really.
Well,
yeah. I know of no other way to treat love, frankly. So
I didn't think Peyton placed it so well. I know certainly about it, but the language wasn't up to it.
Yeah.
You were talking before about the barbershop being a man's world, and yet one of the most beautiful characters in Operation Burning Candle is the woman who gets Aaron, she sort of brings him into maturation in a certain sense, which is interesting because it's a Jungian book.
I think, you know, one of the things that is happening for black men is a reevaluation of black women and the kind of role that they have all along played in our lives and do much more openly now. She's a bright, talented young woman who still feels a deep commitment, I think, as all black women have.
And while she's willing to impart knowledge to Aaron that he doesn't have or is not aware of yet, by the same token, she is willing to draw something else out of him, which is the love thing. I think so many of the young black women have that quality, and I wanted to try and touch on that and show that for most black men, especially in my generation, the role that women play is a vastly new, different, but very important kind of role.
Well, it turns out actually to be a kind of Jungian role that she plays, because she knows that point where she will cease to help him grow.
Mm-hmm.
And she sends him on, which ties in beautifully with the whole Jungian business, you know, that she's there in his life more or less to help him come to terms with something in himself, and once he's come to terms with that, she knows it.
Yeah, I hated to break him up, you know. Many people think that writing is just dealing with words and ideas, but it really is dealing with feeling, and you get to love your characters, and you say, gee, I really hate to do this. And you go around and you go out and have a beer because you feel so bad about what you just did, kind of thing.
You think she's going to come back in any of the other stories?
I don't really know. I don't.
She's a very beautiful creation. I think that in terms of her brief appearance and the intensity of that appearance, she's like Luciana in Catch-22. You know, she appears in only one chapter or two chapters, and yet we remember her for a long, long
forever,
time.
Forever, right, forever.
What do you think you're going to title that Bellevue novel? I think Bellevue would be a marvelous title for her.
Yeah, I had said I was thinking of Waiting for Spring. I think that's been used. I don't really know.
30 Days Observation.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Like that.
That's the last thing that comes, really.
Really? and you should leave it for the publisher, too. Well, thank you, Blyden Jackson, for giving us this background on your writing. I want to remind our audience that we've been talking with Blyden Jackson about his novel, Operation Burning Candle. Operation Burning Candle is published by The Third Press at 444 Central Park West, New York, 10025. That's 444 Central Park West, New York City, 10025. Operation Burning Candle has been hailed as a remarkable first novel by such critics as Sidney Offutt and Barbara Bannon, by such periodicals as the New York Times and Publishers Weekly. To their praise, add that of Walter James Miller of New York University.